This is an RNZ podcast.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Thank you.
People sometimes say thank you to journalists for covering a story. After Christchurch, Muslims were coming up to me and saying thank you so much for what you've done for us. But this time, it affected me differently. I was ashamed because I wasn't there for them when they needed me.
That was News Hub's national correspondent Patrick Gower on 3's The Project last Monday, telling the viewers he'd fallen down on the job after Christchurch. But what exactly was he apologising for?
Over the years, I have reported on threats to New Zealanders like Islamic State, the GFC, earthquakes and climate change, and stories where the threats were overblown like Y2K or Judith Collins becoming leader of the National Party. But in 20 years, I have not done one story on white supremacy. Honestly, me and many other Kiwi Junos didn't see it as a real threat. This was an American problem or a European problem.
And to try and put that right, Patrick Gower had been investigating white supremacy here at home for a series of reports all week on News Hub at 6, tagged Because It Matters, and they were heavily trailed on air like this.
Hate is alive and well in New Zealand, hidden in plain sight. A subculture of white supremacy flourishes online. In the first Because It Matters News Hub special, Patrick Gower exposes the racists.
Patrick Gower's series focused on some of the far-right figures that have come to light lately and some of the unmoderated online forums where the worst of the far-right and racist stuff circulates. Back on The Project last Monday, Patrick Gower also made a specific apology about something that happened before the Christchurch mosque attacks in March.
I should have known all of this last year before sitting down with Stephen Molyneux and Lauren Southern. I underestimated them on the day, I was underprepared on the day, and they steamrolled me on the day.
That interview he spoke about there with the far-right provocateurs from Canada who visited late last year didn't go well, as he said. Many people reckoned that the media played into their hands and created a fake free speech frenzy that only amplified their divisive and racist messages. But back then, when Patrick Gower went on The Project to talk about that, he didn't really seem sure whether he'd won or lost the argument or made a big mistake by giving them the oxygen of publicity in the first place.
Well, it was sort of like being thrown down in front of a machine gun of sort of nitpickery, where you could sort of say to them, hey, look, the sky is blue, and they would sort of come back to you and say, no, it's not. You know, yeah. And
not firm friends with the facts is my impression.
Yeah, but they're very good.
Well-rehearsed.
They're very well-rehearsed at not being firm friends with the firm facts or whatever it is. Yeah. You know, they're very good at that. They're professionals, and actually in some respects, in terms of having an intellectual argument with them, they totally nailed me. I just could not compete with them.
Now, back on The Project this week, Patrick Gower swapped the Eminem backing track for Buffalo Springfield to wind up his report like this.
I get it now, and I promise to do better. And to all the young Junos out there, these guys are a real threat to New Zealand. Dig in, investigate, and don't make the same mistakes that I did. Do your job. I know you will. And I'll tell you another thing. I'm ready for another go with Stephen Molyneux and Lauren Southern.
Well, while Jesse Mulligan might pay money for that, he'd be in a pretty short queue at the box office. Turning the spotlight on the far right is a good thing, as is keeping the focus on the victims in Christchurch. But the business model of the likes of Southern and Molyneux depends upon mainstream media giving them the platform and the propaganda oxygen of publicity. But even if Patrick Gower turned the tables and steamrolled them in the rematch that he called for, they'd surely just default to claiming that they were the victims of PC-driven media hostility, and it's not hard to work out who wins from that. Meanwhile, the official efforts to get at what happened in Christchurch and why are also getting underway in the form of the Royal Commission of Inquiry.
The Commission has now issued an 8-page minute saying it's still considering whether its work will be done entirely in private. It says it's very early days, but it's possible the public and the media will be shut out of the vast majority, if not all, of the hearings.
RNZ's Katie Scotcher there on Morning Report last Tuesday, talking about how much of the Royal Commission of Inquiry on the Christchurch mosque attacks will be behind closed doors. Though, as Katie Scotcher acknowledged, there are reasons for that.
There are national security considerations, and there are currently criminal proceedings underway against the man accused of the massacre. The commission also says the inquiry must adhere to the accused man's fair trial rights.
Meanwhile, in Paris, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was also asked on Morning Report about the level of openness we could expect.
But as your understanding, those hearings, they will all be behind closed doors? No, that's what's being said at home.
No, again, I haven't, and it is not my role to instruct the inquiries as to how they carry out their work. Our expectation at the end point is certainly that there will be a public-facing document so the public can see the outcome of their inquiry.
Now, the Prime Minister was in Paris for another inquiry into the Christchurch mosque attacks, a special summit to pressure social media companies to take more responsibility for violent and extremist content on their platforms. And that concluded with the Christchurch call to action on Thursday. Now, at this event was as public as could be in the run-up. Both our Prime Minister and her co-host and counterpart from France invited and encouraged the media coverage, and there was plenty of that here, even before Jacinda Ardern boarded the plane for Paris with a squad of local reporters in tow. Last Sunday, the New York Times, for example, published an opinion piece by Jacinda Ardern in which she revealed that she herself had seen the gunman's gruesome video posted on Facebook, and she wound up with this claim.
This is not about undermining or limiting freedom of speech. It is about these companies and how they operate.
But could the media and journalism be caught up in all this too? Well, that's a question we'll come to in a minute. In the run-up to Thursday's summit in Paris, the first measure of success was who would be there. Facebook's big boss Mark Zuckerberg and his deputy both gave it a swerve, sending instead its most senior global PR person, Nick Clegg, a living, breathing symbol of the company's clout, given that he was Deputy Prime Minister of the UK as recently as 2015. But Twitter's chief executive Jack Dorsey turned up, as did Microsoft's president Brad Smith, and senior representatives from Google, Amazon and Wikimedia. The heads of state from Canada, the UK, Ireland, Norway, Jordan, Senegal, Indonesia and the European Union all came too. But no politician from the US was there, and only one from anywhere in Asia. And that's a shame, because it's estimated that half the world's social media users are there, and the fastest growing platforms too, though these were hardly mentioned among all the criticism of Facebook and Twitter in the run-up to the Paris summit. Later on Wednesday, Facebook suddenly said in a statement that anyone who violates their most serious policies would be temporarily banned from its live streaming service. And the company claimed this would have stopped the live stream of the Christchurch mosque attacks. In which case, why was it only 2 months later it was taking only this limited action once it was under the media spotlight? Writing for Stuff, technology writer Paul Brislin was unimpressed.
We're not told what rules must be broken, and we're not told how the policy will be applied and what happens if they do it more than once. It is literally the very least Facebook could do in this situation.
Facebook is one of the tech companies that signed the Christchurch call, but what is it that the 17 governments have signed up to, and what could it mean for the media there? Well, the Christchurch call to action obliges the signatory nations to enforce the banning of objectionable material and also to set guidelines on how traditional media can report acts of terrorism without amplifying them. It also says they should encourage media outlets to apply ethical standards when depicting terrorist events online and support frameworks to ensure that reporting on terrorist acts does not amplify terrorist and violent extremist content without prejudice to responsible coverage of terrorism and violent extremism. Now, those sections of the Christchurch call do go beyond social media and into the territory of the news media. And from Paris, Newstalk ZB's political editor Barry Soper reckoned Jacinda Ardern has in part created a problem that doesn't exist.
It's not for the politicians to dictate how events should be covered. The New Zealand media, as it showed in the Christchurch massacre, is responsible and doesn't need to be told how to do their jobs.
Barry Soper, in an article published by the New Zealand Herald Online and in an article published in the US and here, Dr. Courtney C. Ratch, the Director of Advocacy at the Committee to Protect Journalists in Washington, D.C., sounded this warning.
The Christchurch call is an understandable response to tragic events, but it is more likely to strengthen the hand of the censors than mute the voices of the terrorists.
So this week I asked Dr. Raj, why would this effort to get social media to clean up be a threat to the media's freedom or to individual journalists around the world?
The idea that governments are calling for, responsibility by news organizations, I think, could be concerning, because we see that type of language used by governments in more repressive countries to justify repression of independent reporting, to crack down on critical reporting. And what we don't want to happen is for media to be accused of, amplifying terrorism when in fact they're trying to report on legitimate issues related to terrorism.
So as one possible example of that here in New Zealand, I mean, after the attack on the 15th of March, one of our news organisations put up a story on its website, which was a legitimate news report, but it was headlined, you know, 17 Minutes of Terror, a reference to that online video. The story included a couple of still images from social media stuff that the gunman had posted. I mean, all this being done in the just when editorial decisions are a bit difficult. A lot of people thought, look, that's too clickbaity. Are you worried that that sort of reporting might then be the subject of, you know, criticism or even censorship because of governments signing up to an agreement like this?
I think that is the type of censorial action that we would be concerned about. And I don't think that it's only hypothetical, because we've actually seen, there was an article on one of the most popular news sites in Australia about an ISIS, you know, Islamic State related article about how, you know, the recruitment strategies and how they were using these various different online marketplaces to recruit. And the e-safety regulator deemed it to be supportive of terrorism, and they basically were forced to take it offline. That's despite the fact that the Independent Press Council determined that it was in the public interest. Now, that, you know, very specific example relates to terrorism, and it draws concerns about who is making these decisions. And we talk about clickbaity, but let's be clear, the technology platforms have completely reconfigured the environment in which these news organizations operate. So it's a little hard to blame them for using clickbaity headlines when they're depending on those clicks to sustain their news operations.
But to read directly, Courtney, from the Christchurch Call to Actions text here, it says, you know, that we, the governments, commit to, and one of the provisions is, encourage media outlets to apply ethical standards when depicting terrorist events online to avoid amplifying terrorist and violent extremist content. And then just below that, to support frameworks such as industry standards. And then it specifically says, without prejudice to responsible coverage of terrorism and violent extremism. It's not laying down the law on this. It's encouraging the industry to do this. And in many cases, the news media do broadly abide by such principles themselves.
Right. So that's why I think that it's concerning that the government is calling for the media organizations and news outlets to act responsibly and alluding to the idea of some sort of, you know, government regulation or government code of conduct. So even though it's saying encourage, I mean, again, how do they encourage it? Is it encouraging it through inducements, through, you know, veiled punishments? I mean, we know that online censorship and that self-censorship can be propelled by governments that are encouraging or discouraging particular behavior. So I think in general, we want governments to stay out of editorial decision-making processes.
But if the principle is getting these online platforms, particularly the ones with big names like Facebook and Twitter that are truly global, to set some sort of editorial standards for themselves that approximate the ones that the news media do, and if they might be backed up with some sort of enforcement, that wouldn't in the end be a bad thing for public well-being.
Well, I think we have to really question that. Terrorism and violent extremist content is very poorly defined. In many parts of the world, opposition groups are labeled as terrorist groups. So, for example, in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood is a designated terrorist group. In Turkey, the PKK is a terrorist group. So this idea that somehow we're all going to agree on what the narrative should be, who should be allowed to try push their message online, I think is really, really problematic. Also, you rightly pointed out that there is this focus on the big platforms. A, there is a dominance, of course, in the social networking sphere by Facebook, given that more than 2 billion people are on that platform, and so things can go viral. That's something to consider, perhaps, about, you know, how the platform is designed, more so than around the content itself. I think that there is important recognition that terrorism is a complex social problem. This is maybe the fourth year that I've been writing about this problem of trying to moderate content online. What we saw happen in Syria with the Syrian archives and with citizen journalism is that it was taken off and blocked on YouTube and on Facebook because of algorithms that misidentified it as terrorism. So this has real implications for policymaking, for example, in Syria, where you want to have a lot of different sources of information. So it is not easy to try to address a real problem like countering violent extremism or terrorism, thinking that we can do that through deciding what content we should allow online or not. And who is going to decide that? And do we want to have one set of rules for all of the online media ecosystem? Or is it better to have different platforms that have their own terms of service for the types of content that they're going to allow on their platforms?
And you mentioned there a lot of the focus on those big platforms like Twitter and Facebook. Other people have pointed out, look in the composition of the people that attended and have signed up to the Christchurch call, Asia virtually excluded. I mean, Indonesia was represented there, but you know, you have something like estimated half the world's social media users in the Asia Pacific region, so I believe. And look, platforms like Weibo, WeChat, that are in China, where I guess there's a different kind of control, but also Line, KakaoTalk, you know, these hugely and what broadly used social media platforms in Asia, they weren't part of this discussion whatsoever.
That's correct. And we also know from researchers studying how extremists and terrorists are using these platforms to disseminate their messages is that these large, you know, dominant platforms are part of the strategy, but they're certainly not all of it. We know that 8chan, for example, played a significant role in some of the memes that were created. We know that Kick and Last.fm and you know, even chat rooms in video games. You know, there are many, many places that those who would like to recruit to their cause or disseminate their propaganda and hate online are going to go. And it just seems like we're never going to scrub the internet of social ills that exist. I don't think that we're ever going to be able to create a policy that does not, or a regulation that does not get journalistic content involved, that does not infringe on the ability of activists and those without the power and access to mainstream media that depend on these platforms.
One interesting thing you also wrote, Courtney, was the sweeping focus on online service providers risks putting censorship into the infrastructure layer, commonly thought of as the layer that makes the internet work. This could include domain name service providers, internet service providers, and cybersecurity providers. So looking at that, you seem to say that's a danger, but I guess people would say, well, if bad stuff is circulating on the internet, what's the problem with it getting into it at this level?
I think it is up to those platforms to decide, you know, whether users are complying with their terms of service. And I think we should keep in mind a very important principle of press freedom, which is having media pluralism and pluralistic outlets for expression is a really fundamental pillar. Because when you have a plurality of outlets, you can use different outlets for different types of expression. A lot of the times when we're talking about these platforms, we're really talking about a few major social media platforms. We're not really talking about the entire internet. And I think that when we talk about getting into the infrastructure level, these companies are not set up with the expertise on staff to make decisions about, you know, what content should be allowed online or offline. They don't have, you know, content moderation departments. And I don't think we want to get into a situation where, you know, you're trying to register a website and say, get a URL, and that platform is deciding whether or not it likes your point of view or likes what you're going to post on your website. I think that the problem is with these, you know, general sweeping calls for removing terrorism from the internet. It's too broad. It's not specific. It's not really identifying those key platforms and what other factors might be at play facilitating that content from going viral.
Yeah, it's interesting because the organizers of the call were clearly saying, sending out the message, this is going to be quite a narrow focus on extremist, violent content and getting it stopped, such as we saw in Christchurch. So very, very specific. But in responding to it, one of the bigger media groups here, or public interest groups, the Campaign for Better Public Media, they've responded by saying it should go a bit broader. They're suggesting things like an independent regulator, urging prioritization of public interest media and news feeds and web searches, things like that. So I guess this is getting into the era of fake news detection and other areas where the Christchurch call backers didn't really want to go initially. But if a result of this could be that legit acknowledged public interest news media does get amplified by the social platforms that host it, that could be a good result, couldn't it?
I mean, it could be, but I think that is about, you know, regulating the algorithms and the fundamental business model of some of these platforms, which may be a good idea, right? If your platform is based on an algorithm that favors engagement, the design of these platforms encourage certain types of communication, encourage certain types of engagement over others. So there's definitely a design aspect to that. But I do question whether we would be, you know, having this conversation if there were just a greater plurality of platforms, right? But let's be clear that there are these discussions around preventative uploading, for example, preventing the content from getting online at all. I know that the call included a request for transparency reports, which is a good first step. How are you going to train those algorithms and make sure that they're not getting protected or important content taken off of their services to begin with? In addition to transparency reporting, there needs to be an independent audit of the type of content that's taken down so that the algorithms can be better trained, and so that there is some sort of oversight of content that's being removed and deemed extremist or terrorist. But again, what happens when Turkey starts making these requests of Facebook, as they have done with Twitter, to remove accounts of opposition figures or even independent journalists to prevent them from getting out their reporting? And we're seeing that that is a real challenge here. And I don't think that this process really grappled with how we get beyond platitudes around the importance of protecting human rights and freedom of expression while dealing with this extremely problematic content.
And finally, Courtney, I mean, clearly you're alive to the warning about the dangers of expanded censorship, particularly, as you say, in countries without democratic safeguards. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern famously said after Christchurch, they have to realise they're the publisher, not just the postman. But that's still not a responsibility they're going to want to give too much ground on in a hurry, I would imagine, after this agreement.
You know, you've seen calls for regulation from Facebook, but, you know, they're trying to get the kind of regulation they want. Some of these platforms should be considered to have an editorial function. I mean, both through what's chosen, you know, by specific teams, but also, you know, editorial algorithmic decisions. It is a decision, for example, by Facebook to revise its newsfeed to prioritize information from friends and family over information by institutions such as news media. You know, that is going to have repercussions on the type of information that people see.
That was Dr. Courtney C. Raj, Director of Advocacy at the Committee to Protect Journalists in Washington.